bickering for a moment, and then, abruptly, they seemed to reach agreement, and they all flew off. Ian put his hands flat on the rock and lifted himself fractionally, easing his backside into a more comfortable position. The rock was warm from the sun, and under his hands the rough, rounded surface felt like the skin of an ancient beast. "How old are these rocks, do you think?" he said pensively.
"They've been here forever," Pete said. "These are some of the oldest rocks in the world."
Ian looked at him curiously.
"Really?"
Pete nodded. "Bits of the shield are coming on for 3 billion years old."
3 billion?
"This is a top-quality rock, man. It was a mountain range once, high as the Rockies. Then it was under the sea. Then there were glaciers on top of it."
He patted the rock approvingly with his hand.
"Still here."
They climbed on. The rocks rose up more steeply, and sometimes they needed to search for handholds and haul themselves up. And then, abruptly, they scrambled over a crest of rock and found themselves at the top, the lake spreading out below them, dazzling in the sun.
"Wow," Ian said. "I'd forgotten how fantastic the view is."
The sun on the surface of the water was so bright that he had to shield his eyes to look at it. In the distance, the shoreline looked like lace, hundreds of bays and rivers and inlets running off from the vast pool of the lake itself and disappearing into the wilderness.
"What's that at the edge of the cliff?" Pete said.
"Where?"
"There's something in the air."
They were still 30 feet or so back from the edge, but now, looking more closely, Ian could see that the air appeared to be dancing in a strange way, almost like a heat haze, but not quite. At first he thought it was a trick of the light, but as they got closer, he could see that Pete was right. There was something in the air, many things, in fact, thousands of things.
"Holy shit," Pete said. "They're dragonflies."
A curtain of dragonflies was hanging in the air at the very edge of the cliff, hundreds upon hundreds of them, like a vast army of tiny helicopters hovering almost motionless apart from a slight swaying to maintain their position on the updraft of warm air from the lake. All of them were facing inward, as if they'd been on their way somewhere and had come smack up against a sheet of glass.
"What the hell are they doing?"
Ian said, getting as close to the edge as he dared. 300 feet below, the waves were frothing around the foot of the cliff.
"Dunno."
"Have you ever seen them do that before?"
"Nope."
Pete sat down cross-legged at the edge of the cliff, face to face with the dragonflies. He watched them, and they watched him. "Man and bug," Ian thought, grinning at the sight. "Man and bug, eye to eye, on the brim of the oldest rock in the world." He sat down beside Pete, edging cautiously closer to the brim, and focused on one individual dragonfly. They were hovering quite close together, not more than 4 or 5 inches apart in any direction, but they maintained their position so well that it was easy to pick out just one. It was less than 3 feet away. He could have touched it if he'd leaned out over the edge, but it didn't seem in any way perturbed by his presence. They eyed each other, mutually uncomprehending.
"So how old are dragonflies?" he said at last, "since you know so much."
"You mean these particular ones?"
"No, like, when did the first dragonfly fly?"
200 to 300 million years ago."
"That's not a very satisfactory answer, give or take 100 million years. Can't you be a little more precise?"
276,310,422 years ago, on the 14th of December."
"Thank you."
"Any time," Pete said. "If there's any little thing you need to know, just ask."
They sat on in silence, or almost silence. If you listened closely, you could just hear a faint thrumming from thousands of wings. Beyond the dragonflies, the sun was sinking slowly, casting its rays across the lake, and on either side, everything as far as the eye could see was slowly dissolving into the haze. Ian thought, "If I live to be 100 years old, I will always remember this."
It was after dark by the time they got to Lowdown. Most of the others were there already and had a bonfire going. Kathy was there, huddled in a little group of girls who kept shooting dirty looks at Ian. He avoided looking at them. Someone had spread a couple of old blankets out on the sand a few feet back from the fire, and Ian sat down and stared into the flames. He felt strange, distant, and detached. Part of his mind was still back on the cliff, and the other part was too tired for a party. He tried to shake himself out of it. This was probably the last get-together they'd have before they all went their separate ways, but the others didn't seem to feel particularly hyped up either. Someone passed him a Coke, and someone else held out a king-size bag of potato chips. He took a handful and ate them slowly. People were standing around in the shadows at the edge of the firelight. Others were down by the water. Pete was down there looking out over the lake. Maybe he was back with the dragonflies, too, or communing with his mythical muskie. Or wondering what the Mounties were up to on the reserve, and how his grandfather was making out. It was getting cold. The fire had died down enough to cook the hamburgers and hot dogs people had brought, so they did that, and then heaped more wood on the fire and huddled around it. There was a bit of petting going on, but nothing serious. Someone tried to start a sing-song, but it petered out almost immediately, and they sat, mostly in silence, like a bunch of cavemen watching the flames. Earlier, they talked about staying all night, greeting the sunrise together. But in the end, people started drifting away about 1 in the morning. The goodbyes were quiet and subdued. Pete had disappeared some time before, so Ian went home alone. He cycled slowly, wanting to hang on to the feeling of detachment that had taken him over, a state of not being, a state of no time, no past, no present, no future, no decisions. He thought it would be good to stay like that for the rest of his life. When he got home, the car was gone. His father was out on a call. Ian went up to his room. He lay on his bed, thinking of what Jake had said about leaving the North, then thinking about Jake himself. It must be strange coming back after a long absence to the place you grew up in. Strange to see again things that were once so familiar they were almost a part of you. It was hard to imagine Struan or anything in it being a part of Jake. He didn't look as if he had ever belonged. He was a city type, sure of himself, confident. Ian envied him that. He looked like someone who had no doubts about himself or where he was going, someone who knew exactly what he wanted out of life, someone who had all the answers. Chapter 10. Victory Lone Nearing Objective. Runaway Truck Finishes Up in Mill Creek. Temiskaming Speaker, May 1943. The cows needed milking, so he had to get up in the mornings. If it hadn't been for that, maybe he wouldn't have. Maybe he would have stayed in bed, sagging into the mattress, too weighed down with loss to move while the forest crept in and took over the farm. But the urgent lowing of the cows reached him where he lay under his heap of gray blankets, and it wasn't a sound anyone with a heart in him could ignore. Once he was up, other things couldn't be ignored either. The frost had gone, but until a week ago the soil had been too wet to drill. Now it was ready, and the oats and barley, the crops the animals depended on during the long winter months, needed to go in straight away. He was going to need more feed than ever before because they'd increased the size of the dairy herd thanks to their arrangement with Otto, and if he sold them now, he'd make a loss. And then there were Otto's pigs. The piglets could be sold when they reached market weight, but he couldn't sell the sows. Otto depended on them for his livelihood. So there would be the pigs to get through the winter, and the cattle and the horses. He didn't see how he could manage it. It was only ever going to be possible with the use of Otto's land, and one man alone couldn't work two farms. He and his father had figured out that between them, using the tractor and both teams of horses, they could just do it. The tractor. Whenever Arthur thought of it, he saw the giant wheels clawing the air, saw his father's face, purple, eyes bulging out. The day before the funeral, he'd driven it, for the first and last time, back to the Luntzes' farm and stuck it in Otto's barn. He didn't want to see it ever again. But Otto's land was going to be ruined if it wasn't tended properly. There was another worry. He needed to write to Otto and tell him what had happened. Ask him to come back and sort things out. Sell the farm or find someone to rent it to. He knew he had to do it, but the thought of putting all that down on paper defeated him. How would you say it? Dear Otto, Dad was killed, your tractor fell on him. How could you write that? His mother would know what to say, but she got upset when he asked her to do it. There was no point in pressing her. She wasn't in a state to deal with anything at the moment. He would have liked to talk things over with her, tell her of his worries, but it was out of the question. It would have been a relief to tell someone, to have someone else share his fear that they would end up in debt again, that they could lose the farm. Some days he felt he didn't care. Let it go. He had no heart for it now that his father was gone. There seemed no purpose in it anymore. But then he'd think about his mother and Jake. If they lost the farm, what would they do? Where would they go? So Arthur kept working. In the mornings, after the milking was done, and he'd been over to the Luntzes to see to the pigs, he harnessed both teams of horses and took them out to the fields and worked them alternately, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. They worked sun up to sun down, plowing, harrowing, seeding, up one furrow, down the next. The same thoughts kept going around and around in his head, keeping pace with the heavy footsteps of the horses, keeping pace with his grief. He ached with grief, felt sick with worry. Once he said aloud, startling himself and the horses, "What am I going to do, Dad?" And the silence rushed in so hard, so fast, it knocked the breath out of him. He stopped in his tracks, and the horses came to a halt and looked around at him inquiringly. "It's okay," he said, but he was crying all at once, and they looked uncertain. "It's okay," he said again, wiping his face with his sleeve. "Move on." They moved on, and he followed along behind, tears running down. Sticking to the routine was all he knew how to do. But the routine was of his father's devising, and memories ambushed him at every turn. For a few days after the accident, the imprint of his father's behind was still visible alongside Arthur's own in the long grass bordering the field where they'd been sowing the potatoes. It seemed incredible. Just days ago, so recently that the grasses hadn't straightened up yet, they'd sat together, sipping hot sweet tea, surveying how much they'd done, and how much was still to do, not knowing. Had they spoken that last time? He couldn't remember. Probably not. They didn't speak much. There was no need. One of them might say, "Soil's heavy," or "Looking pretty good," and the other might nod, or they might just finish their tea in silence, and heave themselves to their feet, and go back to the teams. Now he found he couldn't sit down for his break. He drank his tea standing up beside whichever team he was using. His father's horses were gentle with him. He'd expected them to play up, unsettled by a strange hand on the plow, but they did not. It seemed to him that they understood. They were the only comfort he had, out there, alone, in the fields, all day. At dinner time, and again in the evening, he'd walk back to the house along the track. And for the first couple of weeks, the prints of his father's boots were still there, like his signature written on the land. Then it rained, and they were gone. That had seemed a treachery, that his footsteps could be erased so easily. How many thousands of times had he walked along that track? All his life. His own father, Arthur's grandfather, had brought the track into being, had cleared the land and plowed the very first furrow behind the broad swaying back of an ox. Their footsteps should have stayed forever. Last thing, at night, he went out to the barns for a final look around before bed, as he and his father had always done, just to check that everything was okay. They used to stand for a minute or two in the farmyard afterward, studying the sky, and Arthur did it still. Couldn't break the habit, though of all the moments of his day it caused the greatest pain. He stood, alone in the silence of the night, remembering. In his mind's eye he saw the two of them, always saw them the same, standing together, faces turned upward, clouds pale against the blue-black of the night, stars cold and bright, the moon hanging there, pale and brilliant, clouds drifting across it like smoke. The sky and the silent land beneath it stretching on and on and on, so that he and his father were shrunk to almost nothing by the vastness of it. Two tiny, insignificant specks, side by side, faces upturned, staring at the sky. They had to write to Otto. There was no way around it. It was mid-July now, and Otto's fields were a mass of sow thistle. They couldn't keep putting it off. He said, "Mum, we've got to tell him. He's got to sell the land or rent it to someone else, or it's going to be ruined." They were at the supper table. Jake was there, for once. Arthur hardly ever saw him anymore. School had finished for the summer, but Jake was always out. Their mother was in a permanent state of panic about him. "Where could he be, Arthur?" she'd say, at 5-minute intervals. "Where do you think he is?" As it happened, Arthur knew where he was, some of the time at least. He was very close at hand, in the hay barn to be exact, with a girl. Not always the same girl. At the moment it was Susan LaRue, a thin, wiry, dark-eyed girl who lived with her drunken bum of a father in a shack down by the sawmill. She was several years older than Jake and had a reputation, and Jake was busy enhancing it. Tonight, though, he was at home, in body, if not in spirit, sitting at the table with them, reading a comic book while he ate. "You're going to have to write to Otto," Arthur said to his mother, trying to speak firmly. He had to make her understand. She was instantly upset. "But, Arthur, they don't know yet what they want to do. They might want to come back. Surely we can keep it in order for them." Her lips were quivering. You'd have thought that after suffering such a loss, nothing else would matter to her, but that didn't seem to be how it worked. She was fearful about everything now. It was as if she had finally seen the awful power of fate, its deviousness, the way it could wipe out in an instant the one thing you had been certain you could rely on, and now she was constantly looking over her shoulder, trying to work out where the next blow might fall. Arthur said, trying to be gentle but still firm, "I can't do it, Mum. I've tried. I just can't cover the ground. Come fall, if Otto doesn't do something, I'm going to have to sell the sows. We're not going to be able to feed them through the winter. We're not even going to be able to feed our own cows. Anyway, I can hardly milk 'em all. It's taking me hours." She said tearfully, "I'll try to help you more, Arthur. I know I haven't been much help." That was for sure. She couldn't seem to get herself together. She would start milking, and half an hour later, Arthur, working his way down the row of patient animals, would find her still in the same place, sitting on the milking stool, face vacant, hands in her lap. Even her own jobs, tasks she'd been doing all her life, the row crops, the farm accounts, the chickens, collecting the eggs, seemed to be beyond her, even cooking the meals. "Oh, goodness," she would say when Arthur came in at the end of the day. "Goodness, Arthur, your supper." She seemed to have lost her mind. That felt like the right expression. She looked permanently bewildered, as if she had just put something down and now couldn't find it. Arthur would get himself bread and cheese, or not bother, just go to bed. If only she would see the truth of what he was saying now. If only she wouldn't argue. He didn't have the strength to argue with her. He was exhausted to the point of despair. But she was going on. "We can't let them down like that, Arthur. Not after all they've been through. We must find another way." "There ain't no other way." He stopped. She jumped and was staring at him, wide-eyed. He took a deep breath and tried to collect himself. There isn't no other way, Mum. There's only me to do it all, and I can't.
You should get yourself a POW, Jake said, not looking up from his comic.
Superman was raising his fist to the sky.
What?
Arthur said, impatiently. All he needed was Jake sticking his oar in. There was no reason on God's earth why Jake couldn't help with the milking, but of course he didn't. Jake did nothing. Jake did nothing so consistently, so defiantly, that it was almost as if their father was still alive and Jake was still fighting him, still refusing, as a matter of principle, to do one single thing his father would have approved of.
A POW, Jake said. A prisoner of war.
What about him? Arthur said, almost shouted, exasperated beyond endurance. What did he care about lousy, stinking POWs? They could all drown themselves as far as he was concerned.
Jake looked up at him.
You should get yourself one, he said. Lots of farms have them. They're all over the place. There are about a dozen of them working at the sawmill. They got 'em down the mines and everything. He went back to his comic. Arthur sat there, staring at him.
They let POWs work on the farms? He said at last.
Jake flipped a page. He said, Why don't you ever know what's going on, Art? Are you deaf or blind or what?
Arthur looked at his mother.
I don't think it's a good idea, she said, instantly.
He could tell she'd known about it, deliberately hadn't told him.
Enemies? Working on your farm? It's not safe.
They don't let the dangerous ones do it, Mum, Jake said.
How do they know who's dangerous? Their mother cried. They wouldn't know until it was too late, until we're all dead in our beds.
Arthur was trying to take it in. A prisoner of war, working for you, helping out in the fields.
Don't they run away? He said at last.
Where to?
Jake said. He tossed the comic aside and reached for the bread.
Anyway, they're too scared of bears, he grinned. They wear this uniform, blue, with a big red circle on the back, like a target, and somebody told them the bears really go for the red circle, like bulls. A couple of them broke out the first week, someone said, and after 2 days they were back, asked to be let in.
Arthur turned it over in his mind, looked at it this way and that. His mother said,
Arthur, I won't have them here. They're Nazis, murderers.
Arthur said, Can you have more than one?
Dunno, Jake said.
Arthur, his mother said, her voice low and trembling, we are not going to have murderers on our farm.
Their names were Dieter and Bernhardt. Arthur didn't catch which was which at the time, and never did know for sure, and they were delivered bright and early one Saturday morning, dumped out of the back of a truck, like a couple of young bullocks.
There you go,
the guard said. He was a scrawny little guy with wispy white hair and a rifle bigger than he was. He must be one of the veterans from the last war. They were the ones who guarded the prisoners.
They're all yours. You can keep 'em here, or we can take 'em back to the camp at night. Up to you. Of course, you lose a couple hours' work if you do that, so if I was you, I'd keep 'em here. They get 30 cents a day, 20 cents bonus if they do a real good job. Don't give it to them. Give it to us. We keep it for them. They get 3 meals a day. If you keep 'em here, they can sleep in the barn till it gets cold. Then you got to take 'em into the house. What's it to be?
They were about 16, Arthur guessed. Younger than Jake, but strong-looking, both of them. Not thin and weedy like Jake was. They looked scared to death. They were watching him, as though they thought he was going to stab him in the belly with a pitchfork. It made him uncomfortable.
"So, what's it to be?" the guard said again, sucking his teeth.
Arthur couldn't see him slitting anybody's throat. They were just kids. His mother was hiding in the house, cowering behind the sofa, probably, or crouched inside a cupboard. It troubled him to add to her fears, but it couldn't be helped. Anyway, she'd be okay once she saw them. He wasn't going to waste 2 hours working time a day.
"I'll keep 'em here," he said.
"You can't mistreat 'em," the guard said warningly. Geneva Convention, for one thing. And for another, if you mistreat him, the Krauts'll mistreat ours, tit for tat. So don't knock him about, and don't starve him. Somebody'll check up on him from time to time, check they're working all right, and you're treating them okay.
I ain't gonna hurt them, Arthur said.
Tell them that. I don't speak no Kraut, the guard said, and they don't speak no English. Some do, but these two don't.
That was fine by Arthur. He didn't speak it much himself, though he would have liked the boys to know that he meant them no harm.
They know anything about farming? He said hopefully. Like, do you know what they did before?
What did people do in Germany? Fought wars, mostly. Probably these two had been in the regular army or a weapons factory or something.
They were at school, the guard said, consulting a sheet of paper. But they both grew up on farms. That's what it says here, anyways.
Yeah? Arthur said, hardly daring to believe it. He looked at the boys, who were watching him apprehensively. He waved his hand at the fields, raised his eyebrows inquiringly. The boys looked at each other, shifted their feet uneasily, whispered together. Then they shook their heads violently.
Ah, said Arthur. He'd known it was too good to be true.
They didn't understand you, the guard said. I reckon they thought you were saying, were they going to try to escape? Try something else.
Like what? Arthur said.
I don't know what. What do you do on a farm? Show 'em a tractor or something. Show 'em a cow.
The boys were looking apprehensively from the guard to Arthur and back again. Arthur pointed to the cows grazing peacefully 2 fields away. The boys looked bewildered. Arthur made milking motions with his hands. The boys looked at each other, and you could see the light dawn. You could literally see it. They both grinned and looked back at Arthur and made milking motions to match his own. Beautiful, firm, graceful milking motions. You could hear the milk hissing into the pails. Arthur felt himself smiling, felt relief flowing through him like a wave of cool cream. He loved those 2 boys. He even loved the guard. He wanted to fall on his knees and thank somebody, but he wasn't sure who. God? The government? Jake? They knew how to work, those boys. Up at 5 to milk the cows, doing the job properly, giving the cows a little something to munch on to keep them happy, washing down their udders well, milking them swiftly, giving them a quick pat of thanks, and moving on down the row, then into the kitchen, bright and eager for a quick breakfast of porridge and bread and butter, then out to the fields till noon. In for dinner, pork from Otto's pigs, or maybe a chicken with vegetables from the garden, served with much clucking and wordless urging by Arthur's mother, who had been converted within 10 seconds of seeing their scared young faces. Back out to the fields until sundown. It turned out that neither of them was all that good behind the plow, but they were trying hard and getting better. They worked as if their lives depended on it, worked until Arthur wondered if maybe they were still afraid he'd beat them, or maybe afraid he'd say they weren't good enough and send them back to the prison camp, and then they'd be sent somewhere worse. But then, seeing one of them lean his face into the warm neck of a cow one morning and straighten up a minute later with his eyes suspiciously moist, he figured it out. They were homesick. Homesick, and the cows and the pigs in the heavy soil were as near as they could get to home. It was their father's fields they were seeing all day as they worked Arthur's land. Arthur could understand that. He'd have been the same. And in fact, in some vague way, quite apart from their usefulness, their presence here on his father's farm was a comfort to him, too. Even the fact that they couldn't communicate with words seemed right. They were definitely good for his mother. She liked having them to fuss over. "Such nice boys," she said. She was still anxious and distracted, but she was better than she had been. At least she had meals ready on time. "They're so polite." They said Dankeschön when she set their dinners down in front of them and carried their plates over to the sink when they'd finished. Their parents must be good people like Otto and Gertie. Brought their boys up to be polite and hard working.
Yeah, Jake said, tipping his chair back on its hind legs.
They straighten the straw in the barn every morning when they climb out of it, sweep it into nice straight lines, polish the cows.
"I wish they'd sleep in the house,"
his mother said, not noticing Jake's tone. She'd made up beds in the parlor, put pillows on the floor, and folded blankets for mattresses, and shown them to the boys. But they'd shaken their heads politely, and indicated that they liked the barn.
"Probably used to barns," Jake said. He rocked back and forth, looking vaguely out the window. "Probably live in barns at home. It would be nice if they washed now and then, but you can't have everything." She noticed that. "Jacob," she said reprovingly, "they wash at the pump every single morning." Jake kept on rocking, gazing at nothing.
"Do they? Must be just part of them, then. Maybe Nazis just stink like that naturally."
Funny how much he disliked them, Arthur thought, when he was the one whose idea it had been to get them in the first place. But who knew what went on inside Jake's head? Arthur had seen him out in the fields one evening. It was such a rare sight that he had stopped and looked again to be sure it was Jake. He was standing at the edge of the ditch where their father had died, not doing anything, just looking down into the ditch. It had seemed to Arthur that he looked rather a forlorn figure standing there, which was odd, because the last word you would ever use to describe Jake was forlorn.
Arthur took one team of horses and either Dieter or Bernhard over to the Lunds farm. The fields were in a bad state, thick with weeds, but if they ploughed them under, they might just get a little barley in and hope for a longer-than-usual summer. It was worth a try. But in the farmyard, Dieter, or maybe Bernhard, suddenly stopped in his tracks, staring at the ground in front of him.
"What?" Arthur said.
The boy pointed down at his feet, looking at Arthur, eyes wide. Arthur looked down. There was nothing there, not so much as a blade of grass. They were outside the barn where Otto kept the tractor, and the ground was packed hard from the tractor's weight, the tread mark set in there like concrete.
"What?"
Arthur said again. The boy knelt down and traced his finger around one of the tractor treads. He looked up at Arthur and pointed to the barn, eyebrows raised in question. He stood up and went to the barn and pulled the door open, the hinges already creaking with rust from lack of use. The tractor was standing where Arthur had left it the day after his father's funeral. The sight of it made him feel sick. The boy climbed nimbly up onto it, sat himself down, and gripped the steering wheel with both hands, grinning from ear to ear. So, in Germany they had tractors. Probably the other boy drove one, too. Which explained why neither of them was much good at ploughing with the horses. The boy pointed past Arthur to the fields beyond and raised his eyebrows hopefully.
"No," Arthur said.
It came out flatter and harder than he'd intended, and the boy stopped grinning and got down off the tractor. He came out and closed the door of the barn and stood with his back to it, looking puzzled and a little bit scared.
"It's okay," Arthur said. "We just don't use it, that's all."
The boy nodded vigorously as if he understood and agreed. He went to the horses and led them over to the gate. Arthur stood where he was, looking past the boy to the sprawling fields of weeds. He thought of his father, not as he had been in the final terrible moments of his death, but as he had been in life. He'd been stubborn, sure, but not to the point of downright foolishness, not to the point where he'd allow a neighbor's land to be ruined when it was in his power to save it. Not when there was a war on and the country needed every last mouthful of food it could produce. Using the horses, it would take Dieter Bernhard, inexperienced as he was, a whole day, sun up to sun down, to plough half an acre of land. Arthur could do double that. But according to Otto, with a tractor, you could do 4 to 5 acres in that time, and here was a boy who knew how to use it. Arthur could guess what his father would say up there in heaven if he happened to be looking down at the moment.
"Stupid,"
he'd say, spitting the word out like he did when he was really disgusted by something.
just plain stupid.
If Arthur tried to argue with him, if he said, "But I hate it, Dad," his father would snap,
"So what?"
The boy had opened the gate and was leading the horses through. Arthur cleared his throat.
"Well, just a minute."
The boy looked around at him.
"Maybe you could use it here,"
Arthur said reluctantly. Dieter Bernhardt craned his head forward a little. Both boys did that when they were trying to guess Arthur's meaning.
"Just here, though,"
Arthur said warningly, spreading his hand across Otto's fields and then bringing it down sharp to mark the boundary between the two farms.
"It ain't coming on our land. I don't want to see it. Just keep it here."
He didn't see it. The boy took care of that.
But sometimes he heard it. Sometimes when the wind was in the right direction, the heavy growling of it drifted across from Otto's farm.
Strangely, though, it wasn't his father Arthur saw when he heard the sound. It was Carl. Carl sitting high up there on the tractor, eyes narrowed against the sun, churning his way down the field as if the past 4 years had never been, as if the whole bloody mess of the war and everything that followed from it had been nothing but a bad dream. It was the summer of 1944 when Reverend March and his daughter came to Struan. Reverend Gordon was still overseas with the troops, and in the interim his place had been filled by a succession of clergymen who had come out of retirement to fill the gap, then found the rigors of life in the North too much for them, and left again. But Reverend March was from North Bay, so the people of Struan reasoned he should know what he was letting himself in for. He was an old man, coming on for 70, stern-looking but kindly beneath it, everyone agreed on that, gray-haired and slightly stooped. He was recently widowed, his wife had died of influenza, and had welcomed the move to Struan for his daughter's sake, hoping that a new environment would help her get over her loss. The daughter's name was Laura. She was 17 or 18, very young to be the child of such an old man. She was in church the first Sunday after they arrived, sitting by herself in the pew at the front. Before the service began, her father introduced her, speaking from the pulpit, and she stood up and turned around to smile at the congregation. Arthur saw her, and fell in love so hard that he felt bruised all over for a week. It couldn't have been her beauty that triggered his fall, because she didn't look beautiful that day. Her eyes were red and her face was pale, and the smile she gave the congregation was apprehensive and unhappy.
"Poor little soul," Arthur's mother said on the way home. "It's only been a few months since her mother died. I don't think it was right to uproot her so soon."
Arthur wasn't listening. He was busy trying to still the chaos within. He felt as if something huge had grabbed him and swung him around half a dozen times, and then dropped him on his head.
"They're staying with Dr. and Mrs. Christofferson until the house is ready," his mother said. "It's a shame they couldn't move straight in when they arrived, but they had to wait for Gertie and Otto's permission, and their letter didn't get here till Thursday."
She was taking an interest in things again, sounding almost like her old self. If he'd noticed, Arthur would have been relieved. She was prattling on.
"But Gertie's happy the house won't be standing empty any longer, and of course the rent will be helpful for them. It gives them more time to decide whether or not they're going to come back. It's Gertie, you see. She can't bear to sell it, and she can't bear to live in it. They're still with her sister in Oshawa. Anyway, I told her we'd move their furniture into that big bedroom at the back of the house. Reverend March is bringing his own. I don't know why. I said you and the boys would do it, Arthur. Move the furniture. And it would be nice if you could clear up around the yard so that it looks tidy when they move in, Arthur. Are you listening?"
"What?"
"I said I'd like you and the boys to tidy up around the yard before the Marches move in. Get it looking nice for them, and then help them move their things in. Everything's sitting in Dr. Christofferson's garage at the moment. A big truck brought it all up for them last week. Would you have time to do the yard tomorrow, you or one of the boys?"
"What yard?"
"Goodness sake, Arthur! The Reverend and Laura! Don't you think that's a pretty name? They're moving into Otto and Gertie's house for the time being, at least. If they like it here, they might stay permanently. Maybe if Gertie and Otto decide not to come back, the Marches will buy their house. It would be handy for everybody, don't you think? Anyway, they want to move in as soon as they can.
They were moving into the Luntz's house? That girl was going to be his neighbor? Arthur was stunned. He went over to the Luntz's farm at least twice a day to see how Dieter Bernhardt was making out. He would see her every day, every day. He didn't know whether to be overjoyed or appalled. She'd see how stupid he was, how he never knew what to say. As for helping her and her father move in, that might take hours. He wasn't sure he'd survive hours in her company. When it came to it, it was Laura who looked as if she might not survive.
"Over there, I think," Reverend March said. "At an angle, if you follow my meaning, Arthur. Facing the fire, but not head-on. What do you think, Laura?"
"Yes," Laura said. "Yes." Arthur held the great high-backed armchair in front of him like a shield. He had to peer around the wing of it like a child afraid of monsters to see where Reverend March was pointing. He set the chair down, carefully.
"Excellent," Reverend March said. "That's perfect, don't you think, Laura?"
"Yes," Laura said. "Yes, that's nice." Arthur was bringing their things in on his own. He'd sent Dieter and Bernhardt off in the truck to collect more of the March's furniture from the doctor's garage. He'd had a moment's unease as he watched the truck rumbling off down the road, two POWs who'd been given the perfect getaway vehicle. If the prison camp guard got to hear about it, he would have a heart attack. But half an hour later, they were back. They just plain didn't want to escape. They'd made three trips already, picking things up from the garage and unloading them in the farmyard, chairs, beds, lamps, a sofa, a dining table, a bureau, a sideboard, chests of drawers, all of it standing with its feet in the dust. Arthur carted into the house everything he could carry on his own. Reverend March had tried to help, but Arthur's mother had forbidden it.
"Goodness, Reverend, you mustn't. Or you, Laura. Goodness, no, let Arthur do it. You just decide where things should go."
She was rushing around, polishing things, cleaning things that were already perfectly clean. She kept apologizing for Jake not being there to help.
"He so wanted to be here," she said. "But he'd promised to help a friend today."
Jake had said, "Well, I can't. I'm busy."
"He's a little older than you, Laura, but he had an accident and missed a year of school, so I expect you'll be in the same class in September."
Arthur brought in a small side table. Most of the furniture was big, heavy stuff made of a rich, dark wood he didn't recognize, but feared might be expensive. He was scared he would damage something. He'd given the boys a pile of old blankets to wrap around things when they were loading them, and he brought each piece into the house carefully, easing it through doorways. Reverend March wanted the downstairs sorted first, which seemed the wrong way around. "Shouldn't you sort out where you were going to sleep, first of all?" But Arthur didn't say so. He was trying to get the job done as quickly as possible, for Laura's sake as well as his own. By then, he'd realized the state she was in. It had been quite a while before he'd noticed. For a start, he was fuzzy-headed with lack of sleep. He'd spent the night thinking about her, worrying about making a fool of himself in front of her, worrying that she would not know he'd tried to enlist and would think he was a coward, a zombie, they called them, who had refused to fight for his country. Then, in the morning, when he and his mother went over to the Luntz's farm to open up the house and get it aired, he'd started thinking about Carl again. He kept seeing him coming down the stairs or disappearing around a corner, and it made his insides feel hollow. And then the Marches arrived, and his confusion about Laura came piling back in on top of everything else, and his mind was just a mess, not a clear thought in it. He He had been out in the farmyard when she and her father drove up in the Reverend's old car. Laura was wearing a big floppy hat that shaded her face, so maybe he wouldn't have seen how she looked anyway, but he was afraid to look at her for fear she would see his confusion. He mumbled his hellos to her and her father and carried on carting things into the house. His mother said, "Oh, the poor child," a couple of times under her breath, but she'd been saying that all week, so he didn't think anything of it. He was so aware of her, that was the problem. It was as if she sent out some sort of beam, as if she were surrounded by a light that was denied to everyone else in the world, and worse than that, being aware of her somehow made him aware of himself as well. He became so self-conscious he could hardly walk straight. He was terrified he'd trip over his own feet, drop something valuable, fall down the stairs. But then, about halfway through the morning, he'd suddenly noticed that she was saying yes to everything, absolutely everything, without exception.
"Ah," Reverend Mart said, "the bureau. Lovely. Where do you think, Laura? Over by that wall?"
"Yes," Laura said. "Yes, that's nice."
"Maybe you could move that chair, Arthur, to the right a bit. There, that's excellent, don't you think?"
"Yes, yes, it is."
"Laura, dear,"
Arthur's mother appearing suddenly in the doorway,
"Laura, would you like me to unpack the china for you?"
"Oh, yes, yes, thank you, Mrs. Dunn."
"Should I put it into whatever cupboard I think, dear, just to give you a bit more space? Then you could rearrange it yourself later."
"Thank you, yes. Thank you, Mrs. Dunn." Once he'd noticed it, he kept on noticing it, and finally he'd stolen a sideways look at her. They were in the parlour by then. The Lunces had never used their parlour. Arthur had passed the door countless times, but he couldn't remember ever being in it before. Laura was standing beside her father in the middle of the room. She'd taken her hat off when she entered the house, so now he could see her face clearly, and he was shocked by the look of her. She was extremely pale, her skin a bruised bluish white, and her eyes were terribly swollen, the eyelids shiny and red. She looked like she'd been skinned, like you could see the inside of her, all raw and bloody. He saw that she didn't care where anything went, or whether it looked better here or there. He saw that he needn't have worried what she'd think of him. She wasn't thinking of him. She hardly knew he was there. After that, he stopped worrying about himself. He just brought things in and set them down as quickly as he could. It seemed to him that she was holding herself together by a thread, and he wanted to get out before the thread snapped. The boys came back with a fine load of furniture, and the three of them finished bringing in the pieces for downstairs. Then they all trooped upstairs to sort out the bedrooms. There wasn't much in the way of bedroom furniture, just the two beds and two chests of drawers and a couple of trunks containing bed linen and clothes.
"You've chosen which room you want, haven't you, Laura?"
her father said. They were on the landing, Arthur and one of the boys supporting an iron bed frame between them. Arthur was trying to block out thoughts of Carl. Anxiety about Laura had pushed Carl out of his mind while they were downstairs, but now he was back.
"Yes,"
Laura said.
"Perhaps you'd just show Arthur where you want the bed," her father said. "Oh, excellent. Here comes my chest of drawers."
He disappeared into another bedroom. Laura said,
"This room."
And in the fraction of a second before she spoke, Arthur knew whose room it would be. Laura had gone in and was looking around. Her footsteps echoed on the bare wooden floor. Arthur stood on the landing, holding up his end of the bed frame, wondering if he could ask her to choose another room, knowing he couldn't.
"I guess against this wall," Laura said, disappearing behind the door.
Arthur licked his lips. There was nothing he could do. He nodded at Dieter Bernhardt, and they turned the bed frame on its side and eased it through the doorway. The antlers were gone, of course. There was nothing to show that they had been there but a pockmarking of nail holes in the slatted wooden walls.
"Over there, I guess," Laura said, "against that wall."
They put the bed against the wall. Arthur straightened up slowly. There had been no bodies. That was part of the problem. No funerals, just memorial services. Which meant that it had been possible, some of the time at least, to pretend that Carl and the others were still just over there. Not really dead, just absent. Now, by the act of putting down someone else's bed in the exact spot where Carl's had been, he had made it real. He, Arthur Dunn, the one who had stayed at home, safe and comfortable, saved by his bloody feet, which had never given him a moment's trouble in his life. And Carl and the other guys he'd grown up with, guys he'd sat beside in that damned school year after year, all but a couple who were in hospital somewhere overseas with bits of them shot off, all of them dead. Setting down the bed, shoving it up against that terrible bare wall, it felt as though he were betraying them. Stupid, maybe, but that was how it felt. Laura was saying something. He pulled himself together. "Pardon," he said. He forgot not to look at her, and her appearance shocked him all over again.
"Did you know them well?" she said. "The people who lived here?"
It took him a moment to answer, to be sure that his throat was clear. Then he said, "Yeah, pretty well."
"They had three boys, someone told me," Laura said, "and they've all been killed."
"Yeah."
Were they friends of yours?"
He nodded. "Especially the youngest one, Carl. We were friends." Maybe it was that final detail on top of everything else, or maybe it was just that she was too tired to hold on any longer, but all at once she was crying, silently, still looking at him, not even turning her head away. There was a movement behind him. Dieter Bernhardt, abandoning ship, hightailing it out of the room. Arthur stood where he was.
"I'm sorry,"
Laura said, wiping the tears away with the flat of her hand.
"I heard your dad died, too. I'm so sorry. Everybody seems to be dying. Everybody."
"Yeah," Arthur said. "I know." That was how it felt, all right.
"I'm sorry,"
she said again. "It's okay."
"My dad says it's part of God's plan," she said. "He says we just don't understand. He says everything will turn out for the best, because God cares for us, but I don't believe it. I don't believe he cares for us. I don't believe anyone who cared for you would have a plan like that. Do you believe it?"
Arthur shifted his feet uncomfortably. He said, "I don't know much about that sort of stuff." She wiped her face with her hand again and asked miserably,
"Do you think I'm wicked for thinking that?"
"No," he shook his head. "No." He heard her father's voice on the landing and held his breath, afraid he might come in, but then there was the sound of footsteps going downstairs.
"Do you wish we weren't here?"
Laura said.
"In your friend's house?"
"No," Arthur said. He was dismayed. Had he made her think that? Had his feelings been that obvious?
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, yes, I'm sure. It's good it isn't empty. It's better than it being empty." And maybe that would be so, in the long run.
"Thank you,"
she said, as if he'd given her a gift. She dug a sodden handkerchief out of her sleeve and blew her nose. She said,
"I didn't want to come here to this sad house, but there wasn't anywhere else. I didn't want to come here at all, to Struan, I mean. I don't know anybody. At least at home I had my friends."
She looked at him out of her sore red eyes and said,
"But you've been really nice, you and your mum. Thank you."
Sitting on his bed that night, looking down at his feet, he went over it again and again in his mind. It seemed to him that something huge had happened, that his life had changed forever. In all his days, he couldn't have imagined having such a conversation with a girl. He mustn't kid himself that it meant anything, though. He knew it was just luck, though luck seemed the wrong word in the circumstances. She wouldn't have chosen him to confide in if she'd had any choice. It was just that she was in despair, and he happened to be there. If she hadn't been in such a state, the conversation wouldn't have taken place. In fact, if he hadn't been feeling pretty sick about things himself, it wouldn't have taken place because he'd have fled. He'd have beaten Dieter Bernhardt down the stairs. But she had thanked him for being nice. That meant something, didn't it? Not much, maybe, but something. The following week, a German POW was murdered in the woods down by Crow River, or at least that was where his body was found. Arthur was there when they found him. He and the men he was with weren't looking for bodies, they were looking for bears. 5 sheep and 2 calves had been killed in the area in the previous weeks, and one farmer, Frank Sadler, had had a visit from a bear while he'd been going about his business in his outhouse.
"Did me a favor, really," Frank said, telling the story afterward. "I'd been having a bit of a problem in that department, bit of a log jam, you might say. I was starting to think it'd take dynamite to shift it, but he scared the whole lot out of me in 2 seconds flat. But Lona and the kids, they're all scared to go out there now. Nobody's regular any more, and it's making them bad-tempered. Something's got to be done."
So 6 farmers, Arthur among them, set up a posse and went bear hunting. The truth was, Arthur would rather have gone on his own. That way he would only have the bear to worry about, and not 6 nervous guys waving Lee Enfields around as well. But they had asked him along, which was good of them, granted that they were his father's generation, and he hadn't known how to say no. Having bears on the brain when they came across the body, they assumed at first that a bear had done the killing. Then they saw that there were no teeth or claw marks, and then they saw the man's hands were tied behind his back. From the look of him, he'd been beaten to death.
"Anybody know him?"
Charlie Rugger asked. They were standing in a circle around the body, 6 burly farmers with their rifles pointing at the ground. It was early morning, and the sun was filtering slantwise through the maples, dappling the body with light. The man was wearing the prison camp uniform, dark blue jacket with a big red circle on the back, and the sun made gently flickering maple leaf patterns on the circle, as if the man were a Canadian and proud of it.
"Yeah,"
Lenny Hogenveld said, squatting down so he could see the side of the man's face. It was a mess, but you could just about make out his features.
"He was working for Stan McLean." "Any guesses who might want to do it?" "Sure," Lenny said. "I could name you 24 right off the bat. He's a kraut, isn't he?" "Yeah, but him in particular," Charlie said.
Lenny shrugged. Every Thursday, the Temiskaming Speaker carried a list of northern boys killed, wounded, or missing in action on its front page, and every week the list seemed to get longer. In the follow-up to D-Day, several families had lost all their sons. If the murder was the work of a madman, and from the state of the body it looked as though it were, well, there were plenty of madmen about nowadays, fathers or sons or brothers driven out of their minds with grief and rage. It turned out that whoever had done it had gone for the man in the night. There were signs of a commotion in Stan McLean's barn where he'd been sleeping, straw all over the place. Arthur decided to bring the boys into the house to sleep. It was still warm enough in the barn, and they protested, but he wasn't taking any chances. He also didn't like the idea of Dieter Bernhardt being all alone, out in Otto's fields during the day, but there was nothing he could do about that. Thanks to the driest August for years, the barley was ready to harvest, and they had to get it in. At least Otto's place was occupied now, and most of the fields were visible from the house. He'd hoped that Dieter and Bernhardt wouldn't learn about the incident, but when the guard from the prison camp made one of his visits to check up on them, there were other POWs in the truck, and of course the boys were keen to talk to them. Arthur saw by their faces afterward that they'd been told. He'd hoped Laura wouldn't hear about it, Another death for her to deal with, but that was a vain hope, too. Reverend March was one of the first to be called. Arthur saw her a couple of days after the murder. It was 2 weeks since the Marches had moved in, but he hadn't seen much of her in that time, or at least not close enough to talk to. In the mornings, he and Dieter Bernhardt came over at about 6:30, and though her father was up and sometimes came out to say good morning, and though the tractor must have wakened Laura, she was never around so early. When Arthur came at the end of the day, she and her father were usually eating their supper. He'd get the odd glimpse of her as she passed the kitchen window, but that was all. At first, it was a relief. He was almost as afraid of speaking to her as he had been the first day he saw her. But then he started to think she was avoiding him. Maybe she was ashamed of having broken down in front of him and never wanted to lay eyes on him again. Maybe it was simpler than that. Maybe she had realized that he was nothing but a big, dumb farmer and not worth the effort of speaking to. But that morning, 2 days after the murder of the POW, he was at the farm a little longer than usual. He'd run out of nails. Everybody had run out of nails. It seemed every nail in the country had been requisitioned. And it had occurred to him that there might be some in Otto's shed, which there were, a whole quart pickling jar full. When he emerged triumphantly from the shed, cradling the jar in the crook of his arm, he saw Laura at the kitchen window. She saw him too. She raised her hand in a hesitant wave, then disappeared, and the kitchen door opened, and she came out onto the veranda. Arthur made his way across the farmyard to her, his tongue drying in his mouth.
"I saw the shed was open," she said, as he came up, "and I wondered for a minute, you know, who it was, but then I saw it was you."
She was wearing a short-sleeved dress, grey-blue with a white collar. Her hair was loose and drifting every which way about her shoulders, and her feet were bare, pale, slender, perfectly unblemished feet.
"Oh," Arthur said. "Yeah, sorry. It was me. I was looking for something. I should have told you I was going in there."
"I was just being silly," she said.
She still looked unhappy, he thought, but much better than when he'd seen her last, and beautiful, so beautiful, as if her beauty had been hidden under the dark weight of her grief and now was starting to emerge. There was a silence. Arthur tried to think what else to say.
"Found these," he said finally, lamely, holding up the jar of nails.
She leaned forward slightly.
"Are they nails?"
"Yeah. It's good, 'cause they're short. I mean, not the nails are short, they're all sizes. Just you can't get nails nowhere anymore. Anywhere anymore."
He stopped abruptly. What was he talking about? She wouldn't care about nails, she'd think he was crazy. But she nodded.
"Like everything," she said, "shortages."
"Yeah," he said gratefully.
He looked away. The tractor disappeared behind a clump of trees and reappeared on the other side.
"Well," Arthur said,
but at the same moment she said,
"Is he safe out there, do you think, on his own?"
"Should be okay in the daytime," he said, though he still wasn't happy about it. "I bring him in at night now, though." It sounded as if he were talking about cattle. "Dieter and Bernhardt, I mean. They sleep in the house now."
"Yes," she said. "Good."
Then she added, "Which is the one who comes here? Is he Dieter or Bernhard?"
"I don't know," Arthur said. "I never worked out who's who."
He gave her an embarrassed smile, and she smiled back.
"They're nice, both of them. You can tell."
He nodded. They listened to the tractor grinding away, a German boy riding it like in the days before the war.
"Normally it's real peaceful here," he said,
afraid that she'd think Struan was the kind of place that had madmen and murderers in it in normal times.
"We never had a murder before. There's been fights and stuff, but never a real murder, not that I know of."
"I know," she said. "It's the war. It's making people crazy."
"Yeah."
Another silence. He looked out over the fields and cleared his throat.
Well, should be getting on.
She said quickly, "Thank you for the other day. I didn't thank you properly. I'm sorry. I was upset."
She flushed, and his heart started to thump. But then there was a movement behind her, and the screen door opened, and her father came out.
"Good morning, Arthur,"
he said. He smiled and rubbed his hands together briskly. "You're bright and early, as usual. You people here put us city dwellers to shame."
"Morning."
Arthur felt himself go hot. What if Reverend March didn't like him talking to his daughter? He looked friendly enough at the moment, but what if he got the wrong idea? What if he got the right idea? Anxiously, he held up the jar of nails, as if they were proof of good intentions.
"Found these in the shed," he said.
"Nails," Reverend March said. "I hope you're not planning to set up a black market in them, Arthur."
He smiled, then saw his daughter's feet and frowned.
"Laura, go and put your shoes on."
He spoke gently, but you could see he was displeased, as if he thought she wasn't properly dressed. Laura said,
"It's just my feet, Daddy,"
her tone a little impatient. Maybe they'd had this conversation before.
"Even so,"
Reverend March said. She sighed.
"Well," she said to Arthur, "bye."
"Yeah," Arthur said, shifting his feet. "Bye."
He and Laura's father were left facing each other with nothing to say. The old man smiled and rubbed his hands together vigorously to show his goodwill. Arthur smiled back and rattled the nails. Chopping wood that evening, it came to him that there had been no danger of Reverend March getting the wrong or the right idea about his feelings for Laura. The Reverend would have had no fears on that score whatsoever, because the idea was so absurd it would never have entered his head. It made no difference, the fact that it was absurd. She took over his life anyway. Milking the cows, he thought of her, repairing the binder, cutting the corn, threshing the oats, mending the fence. She was with him every minute of the day. How long did it last, that perfect golden period when he plainly and simply loved her with no fear of